Okay, let's call to order the executive committee meeting for November 19th. Roll call, please.
On the roll for the executive committee meeting of November 19th, 2018, Director Chavez, Director Joya.
He's here. John.
Director Groom. Director Haggerty, Director Miley, Director Ross, Director Sinks, Director Sparing, Director Wagon Connect, Committee Vice Chair Rice, Committee Chair Hudson.
Here.
We have a quorum in the building, but not at the dais.
Thanks, Jim. And soon to be Vice Chair Sinks is here. Now we got him. Waggy's here. All right. We don't need to wait for him for that. Now we have a quorum. Please join me for the Pledge of Allegiance.
I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all.
They'll come straggling in. Okay, public comment is open. Do we have any cards for public comment? Anyone in the public wishing to address us on any item not on the agenda? Public comment going once, twice. I'm looking at Valerie. Nope. Public comment is closed. Next item is approval of minutes for July 23rd. Do we have any additions, corrections, or motions? We have a motion
second.
From Sparing, second from Rice. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, abstained, seeing none. See how quick you get up here, Valerie? We have the hearing board quarterly report for July through September. Valerie Armento.
Good morning. This is the report for the third quarter of 2018, even though we're approaching the end of the fourth quarter. We had four hearings scheduled, although we actually never held any hearings because three of the matters were dismissed and one order was issued denying an emergency variance. Anyone has any questions on more detail, I'd be happy to provide it, but otherwise that concludes my report.
Do we have any questions, any comments, any cards? Seeing none, we'll move to accept the update. Thank you very much. I don't think we need a motion. Next, the much-awaited report from Allison Brooks on the Bay Area Regional Collaborative update.
Thank you for that introduction, Chair Hudson. Thank you, directors. Many of us were together on Friday at the BART Governing Board meeting, and hopefully this isn't too repetitive. I have the opportunity to present some of our discussion on Friday, and I also want to thank the Air District and Wayne Kino and Dr. Coutinho and Henry, who were there to give us an update on the fires and air quality issues as we were in the midst and still are dealing with that. So really appreciated the update, so thank you. And just want to touch base on some of the program areas that BARC is engaging in. On the carbon-free future, I don't have a specific slide on that, but I do want to, you're all familiar, I hope, with the solar ordinance work that we've been doing, BARC with the Air District and BayREN. And we're moving into a next phase of that work and are in an exploratory phase to figure out what are the biggest impact we can have on reducing carbon through that work and working with a consultant potentially to really build out that program. I'm going to talk a little bit about the work that really is an outgrowth of the Government Alliance for Race and Equity work that we've been doing across the agencies. As we're breaking into different bodies of work around that. And one area of work we've been doing across the agencies is to take the methodologies that the agencies have developed to identify the disadvantaged and vulnerable communities across the Bay Area. We've done some mapping of that and overlaid the methodologies with the CalEnviroScreen work, and are taking that map, and we're going to bring that forward and really walk through it in detail, because I'm going to show you next that Director Sinks acknowledged that we have an image of some of that work. Here it is, but it's just a snapshot of the work, and we want to bring in and really walk through the communities that emerge out of that overlay of the mapping.
I'm sorry, Alice.
Yeah.
I like the way you acknowledge Director Sinks and how fast you got past that map. it just had to be, for those of you that were there, that was Keep going. I'm sorry.
No, that's okay. I learn. So what are we going to do with this map? I think we want to understand we've identified these places that show up through all of our work that aren't necessarily seeing the outcomes that we want to see in these communities. So how can we design and think about our programs to have a greater impact, whether it's air quality, whether it's mobility, whether it's displacement concerns? So how are we as agencies presenting ourselves in a way that's not necessarily a burden to these communities, where we're asking them to participate in different things all the time, but how are we being better service providers and really designing our programs to have the biggest impact in these really important communities that we need to see improvements in working alongside them? So want to acknowledge some of the needs assessment work that's doing, you know, the AB 617 work. I know the Air District staff has been just working so hard and are conducting a needs assessment in some of these same communities. We're working together in some of those through some of the other work underway, the ART Bay Area work, Adapting to Rising Tides Bay Area work. We're working with the Bay Area Regional Health Inequities BARHI, which is all the health departments from all the counties working together. We're working alongside them to do some of this needs assessment work and finding community partners to work alongside us in that work. And I am working on developing a strategic partnerships proposal that's due at the end of this month. Maybe we can bring some additional resources in that could be invested in working with these communities. So more to report on that. Again, we'll just swing by that map. And another project I wanted to, which really is, just as a reminder, we are really integrate through BARC, working across our agencies, is this integration of all the issues that our respective agencies are working on. So a lot of my work is on looking at climate adaptation, climate mitigation, displacement, air quality, mobility, all of these issues, and how do we bring those together and work on these on projects across disciplines, across agencies that really are able to produce multiple benefits, acknowledging we have often multiple challenges we're trying to address at one time. So that's something we're trying to accomplish through these SB1 adaptation planning grants, through Caltrans funding, which was Prop 6 funding, and that thankfully passed. So the gas tax funding is actually going into climate adaptation work. Two of these projects emerged out of the Resilient by Design project, the South San Francisco and the North Bay State Route 37, and we know SR37 work is ongoing, but this was a project that really is looking at public access and how do we make connections to the Bay Trail and other opportunities to connect people and create mobility options beyond Highway 37. And then the Dumbarton Bridge approach and East Palo Alto, that whole area is extremely vulnerable to sea level rise, flooding, seismic risks, and is very low income and has a lot of challenges and opportunities to improve quality of life in that community. So these are some of the details there, some images of the project areas. And then I'm going to quickly walk through, if you're familiar with the Resilient by Design project, it was a year-long effort funded by the Rockefeller Foundation, worked in 9 communities, bringing international design teams to help us think about how we take this very scary future before us around flooding and sea level rise, and how do we begin to create use that as an opportunity to invest in our communities and create multiple benefits, improve access, create better amenities for our communities, and address some of these other issues that we face. So we contracted with the Consensus Building Institute to conduct an assessment of the project, really look at what were the benefits we got out of this, what were the lessons learned. Where do we go from here? We interviewed 28 stakeholders that participated in the process, agencies that, you know, crossed the public sector, nonprofits, elected officials, design team representatives to get their input. And what we learned was the challenge really brought resilience to the forefront in the region. It engaged thousands of people in creative process to think big, think long term, It created a lot of energy and enthusiasm and really brought people that aren't usually participating in these conversations into the tent around this discussion. It integrated, as I started in my discussion, integrating social equity ecosystems, the built environment, into problem solving and solutions. How do we address these long-term threats while at the same time kind of managing our near-term concerns as well? And I thought it was so refreshing to just bring in designers and in and of themselves think very differently. So that was a really valuable experience. And then just bringing international perspectives. We don't have all the answers here. So bringing in some of the leading thinkers that are tackling this issue around the world, and this whole notion of how do we solve for multiple things at once. It's a really hard thing for any of us to get our arms around. It's hard for community residents who are dealing with a lot of other issues to get their arms around as well. We learned that social equity is key. I think some of the, you know, what we would learn from this process is it was very fast moving, and a lot of people had, that was challenging for folks, especially in the environmental justice movement, you know, in that where they have very principles that, you know, you need to engage with the community and all very legitimate criticisms of the process. So what did we learned from that. At the same time, this process really opened up and was a very open process that allowed everybody to participate. So we were open to the dialogue and the very invigorating dialogue around how we partner with community in a really meaningful way over the long term to tackle these challenges. And it can't just be these kind of one-off processes, but how do we build these partnerships and really cultivate them and continue to kind of work together as we deal with these real challenges that are before us. And see what other learning. Real a lot of value working with young people and children and high school students and elementary school students that brought them into the process. It brought a lot of energy and a lot of just refreshing thinking and approaches to the work. And working with academic partners like UC Berkeley brought in a lot of future leaders in the field. So that was valuable as well. So I touched a little bit on the challenges and then the challenges moving ahead. Of course, we're trying to figure out how to fund a next phase of work, potentially 2 years, where we could take the projects themselves and really help to implement them over the next 2 years, really take some of those high-level concepts and drill down and help to really start moving them in our communities. And continue to work on this residual distrust that exists, this relationship between government and community, and how do we continue to kind of work on that and really build those partnerships that are essential for tackling these big challenges. So more to report on this. We're hoping to bring forward a next phase, an approach to the next phase of work. And I'll thank you. Great. Happy thank to answer
you.
Any questions.
Thank you, Allison. Any questions of Allison? Any comments? I have one, and it was only because you mentioned the word solar in your report. I had a family dinner on Saturday. My son worked for the ISO. Now he works for SMUD. And I asked him the question, have you noticed any difference in the efficiency of solar with these fires? And the answer was yes, but he didn't go further into what exactly it is. It may be something we need to, at least as an information item, find out how much of a difference it makes. Director Joy.
I just wanted to make a comment on the resilient by design part of it. Appreciate, Allison, your, summarizing it, as one of the sites, as you know, the site in North Richmond, which our office participated in, I just wanted to note, it was a really great process. It engaged the community in terms of identifying opportunities for resiliency on the North Richmond shoreline and some projects in North Richmond. And I know we've had a follow-up meeting, you know, with the group to look at how do we sort of move forward and take the planning that was done and look at some meaningful community projects. So I just wanted to note, it was great to have this because it engaged community and it allowed folks to think big, vision, and yet look at some specific projects. So I just wanted to say that it was a great process with regard to at least our site. And I've heard the same thing from this other sites around the Bay Area.
Thank you.
Okay. Thank you. Before we accept the update, Marcy, any cards on this? Seeing none, thank you, Allison. We accept that. Move on to number 6, update on production system office and authorization to execute contract amendments for Production System Office.
Good morning, Chair Hudson and members of the committee. This morning we have a team presentation that will go over what we have done over the last year or so on the development of our production system and lays out where we're headed in the future. Blair Adams, our Information System Officer, will kick us off, and then we'll have two demo portions before he comes back to explain our recommendation today.
Thank you. Yes. Good morning, Chair Hudson and members of the Executive Committee. We're here today to provide a status update for the Production System Office. Our agenda will cover, if I go forward, not backwards, our agenda will cover a brief overview of the Production System Office, a status update of our software development activities. We've also invited a few colleagues for a software demonstration. We've got Kevin Vo, a air quality specialist, will be presenting our facility inspections.
Okay, wait, raise your hand. Who's he talking about? Thank you.
We've got Ariana Hussein, who's an air quality engineer, who will be presenting work in progress on major facilities, and Simon Margolis, who's going to be running our demos, also an air quality engineer. Thank you, Simon. The demos will be followed by a short wrap-up, a recommendation, and an opportunity for questions. The Production System Office is comprised of three units: our public websites, the virtual storefront for our constituents, our data management and analytics, focused on information storage, retrieval, and reporting, and our permitting and compliance system, a web-based collaboration portal for the regulated community and district staff. Let's take a quick look at our public websites before we dive more deeply into the permitting and compliance system. So in 2018, our web team has managed to accomplish a number of things. As you can see, our Diesel 3x33 website, we've expanded our language translation. We've done a refresh on our homepage, event and rules enhancements, as well as an asbestos application training module. So the web team's had a pretty solid year. You may remember from a previous presentation, we've now scaled our team to include a third development track for major facilities. We expect to maintain our velocity in the enforcement and compliance area, as well as our continue to deliver enhancements to our production and compliance system. The additional resources will allow us to focus on major facilities throughout 2019. So here's where we're at. We've currently completed our financial integration and 9 permitting and renewal source categories. Those are all shown in blue. We've got 6 modules supporting compliance and enforcement, shown in green, with the most recent additions to our product suite, highlighted in yellow, the last two boxes. In process for the remainder of the year, we're going to be upgrading our payment system, which is going to be great because we'll be able to do e-checks as well as credit card transactions for over $5,000. So it's going to give folks a number of different ways to make payments through our website. We're also going to continue our improvements on the emissions inventory report that we bring in to their resources board every year, as well as fee and emissions design specifications. So we're going to be working through all the various categories that we need to implement to get our major facilities done. So with that, I'm going to move next to Kevin, who will provide a demonstration of our most recent software release, which is our facility inspection module. And it'll be followed by Ariana. I'll give you a sneak preview of our major facilities work. Take it away, Kevin.
Do you want him on this side or?
Up to you.
Yeah. Stereo?
Thank you, Blair. Good morning, Chair Hudson and Executive Committee members. My name is Kevin Vo from Compliance Enforcement Division. I will be presenting on the web-based enforcement dashboard and facility inspection form. The presentation will highlight some of the benefits the production system provides to enforcement staff in their day-to-day inspection responsibilities. In the presentation, we will also focus on some of the key features and functionality of the facility inspection form that all inspectors are using to document their inspections. To gain access to the dashboard, users simply use their district email to sign on. Once signed on, the inspectors can manage their inspection tasks for various programs, such as inspection. for the inspections. The asbestos program and the wood smoke program. The inspection dashboard has a simple design with filter buttons to allow for customized view of the dashboard. The dashboard has an at-glance view to allow users to simply navigate around to find the inspection tasks they would like to work on. Users simply click the specific task, and the system will generate the facility inspection form associated with that facility. And on the facility inspection form, there's information such as permit expiration, and the users can click that permit to operate, and it will take them to the facility page where they can download the permit to operate that's issued to the facility. Inspectors can use this as part of their inspection to find the applicable permit conditions that apply. And on the facility page, they have access to other information such as facility contacts, the permit engineer assigned to the facility, and a listing of all the devices that are permitted to that facility as well. Additional information is available. The users navigate to certain tabs in the facility page, such as the application history for the facility page, for the facility, the compliance history to find out if there's a violation issued at the facility, devices, and inspection history to see when the facility was inspected last. And clicking the documents will allow access to any permit documents associated with the facility. So as you can see, there's a lot of information accessible to the inspector as they do their pre-inspection work off-site, or this information is accessible on-site during the actual inspection. The production system provides easy access to real-time permit and compliance information, and information sharing across different divisions is made easier, and inspectors can access engineering permit files. An engineer can view inspection enforcement data reports. Let's jump back to the inspection form itself. And the inspection form is designed to be very intuitive and easy to use. Users just scroll down the form to get to the sections they want. And there's also shortcut buttons that they can click to get to the sections that they would like. And within the form, there's also form validation that would tell the users if there's missing information that's required or there's errors in the form. And clicking the error button will take them to prompt them to open a dialog box to let them know what actions are required to clear the error. In this example, the recipient field is missing in the form. So to clear the error, the user takes the appropriate action. Here, clicking to add a contact using the contact picker. And once that's taken care done, the error disappears and allows the users to continue completing the form. Okay. So shown here is an inspection report in paper form. It's Microsoft Word-based and requires manual data entry and also processing. In comparison, the web-based facility inspection form, and we'll wait on the inspection form to pop up here. In comparison, the facility inspection form pre-populates a lot of the data fields, so the inspector doesn't have to fill it in. And then the form utilizes pickers and drop-downs to fill out the form. This minimizes the need for long narratives, as you've seen in the report. It makes data entry and documentation less time-consuming. It also standardizes the inspection documentation for improved inspection data document collection. You see here, this is an example of filling out the form. It's a lot of checkboxes, pickers, that fills out the form to minimize the actual data entry manually. And scrolling down to the source data section, these are drop-down pickers that the inspectors can use to fill out the operational status of the device. Inspectors can add additional regulations that they're inspecting to the form by clicking the regulation button or adding additional devices that they would like to add to the to populate the form to do the inspection. The form also allows for enforcement action entry, such as notice of violations and notice to comply. So once the inspector has completed the inspection, they can do a quick review by scrolling down the form. Probably not this quick, but they can do a quick review and then submit, click the submit button to electronically send it to their supervisor for review and approval. So there's a lot of benefits associated with electronic submittal in the inspection process. The key benefits are reducing the need for paper use and manual processing. It improves the efficiency and productivity, allowing for better inspection tracking, management, and accountability for all enforcement staff. And not to mention the elimination of a chance a report gets misplaced or lost. So after the inspection is complete, the system generates this report for Air District records. Thank you, board members. This concludes my presentation. And I'll be turning it over to Ariana for the major facility portion.
So just before we get to the major facility portion, this is a huge sea change for our enforcement staff. Before this point, all of the paperwork that you just saw had to be put in boxes in the inspector's trunk and brought with them. So this is one of the last steps that we need to take before we actually come off one of our legacy systems, which we're hoping to do by the end of next year. Back when I was in the field, when dinosaurs roamed the earth, we would have killed to have this functionality and this information at our fingertips. So this is a very significant change for the enforcement staff and deployment in the field. I think we've heard a lot of good and positive comments about this. So something that shouldn't be minimized and something that Kevin and the staff should be very proud of.
Thank you, Damien. And as Ariana comes up there, that's kind of your lead into the fact that you want us to approve the execution of this contract somewhere along the line?
That will be one of the action items, yes, but this is also a status update, really.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman.
It's a double.
Yeah.
Go ahead, Ariana.
Thank you, Kevin. Good morning, Chair Hudson and members of the committee. Thank you for the opportunity to present this preview of the Major Facility Portal. The Major Facility Portal allows for an easy-to-read, unified view of key information, both at a facility and source level, for all facilities within the district. The portal allows the user to customize their search instead of having to use multiple windows to search the same combination of information. Here you can see the user has chosen to do a partial search on any facility with landfill in the name. Choosing a landfill facility, the portal then provides a succinct list of all devices at that facility, including a short description and the current permit status. Navigating to a source, the user can then view pertinent details about that source. This navigation from facility to device detail level is something that currently can only be done through the use of multiple tools and manual compilation. It is just one of the many ways in which the portal allows for more accurate and efficient work to be produced. Continuing on, the user can view the conditions associated with the source, as well as identify how that condition applies to other sources at the facility. You can see that at the top of the screen. In addition, the tool provides a window for editing the conditions. This feature not only combines the functionality of several legacy programs by providing a one-stop option for viewing and editing conditions, but also adds tools for better formatting, as well as spell check and grammatical validation. By clicking on the Materials tab, A list of the materials associated with the many processes undertaken at the source is presented. Here we can see that landfill gas and landfill, the waste stored at the facility, are the materials used by this device. Furthermore, the user can view any emissions associated with the use of those materials. Here, the portal provides a list of pollutants by material type. By hovering over a particular pollutant, the user can identify the emission calculations associated with that pollutant. This emission window shows both the equation used and the parameters below it. This tool is intrinsic to the work of an engineer, as it provides them with the necessary information to focus on what affects emissions most. You can also see the results are shown at the bottom of this window. The user can also roll up emissions by pollutant category, such as hazardous air pollutants or precursor organic compounds. This roll-up summary allows for easy verification of whether certain regulatory thresholds are exceeded. Finally, and one of the most underlining features of the major facility portal, is that it provides an elegant visualization of the pollutant train, which is currently only represented through a text string. This visualization provides the user with the core information necessary to understand the process as a whole. For instance, if the user should have questions about a device within the emissions train, they can simply click on that device, and the portal navigates them to the device detail window, as you can see here. In summary, the major facility portal provides a unified view of key information, which allows the user to focus on analysis instead of splitting that focus between gathering of information and analysis. Thank you again to the board. I'm now going to hand it back to Blair.
Thank you, Blair. We have a final. I keep thinking there was a third person here.
Blair's going to sum this up, but I think overall you are now beginning to see the fruits of the very long labor that we've put into this particular system. Most of our compliance and enforcement functionality, most of our small permitting functionality is now online. We are giving folks the ability now to pay by e-check, which gives us the ability for large facilities now to come in and start paying their permit fees through this particular system. You've seen there basically the basics of the dashboard that we will be using for the major facilities. And our process going forward now is to really look at bringing the largest facilities online. And that's where our focus will be over the next 12 months or so. So Blair will talk to you a little bit about the areas that we're targeting, and then the costs and contract extensions that we need to move forward.
And before you do, Blair, I suggest all the board members, they turn to agenda item 6 to see what the recommended action is. Go ahead, Blair.
Okay, great. Thank you. Thank you, Kevin, Ariana, and Simon. Great work, by the way, by these folks as well as all the people that are supporting them. And just to summarize, by moving away from paper, we're allowing for a unified view of our permitting and compliance activities. We're improving the access to information, especially for our field staff, as well as providing for more timely and effective collaboration. So coming up, got a little behind on my slides there. There we go. Coming up for 2019 are refinery renewals, enforcement actions, complaints processing, mutual settlements, 1118 health assessments, and permit applications for our non-Title V sources. And for our public websites, our 2019 goals are to upgrade a content management system, improve our interactive visualizations for our maps, air quality index, meteorology, as well as a complete overhaul of the Spare the Air website. And as you might expect, these components have been very busy over the last week or so. We've experienced as much of it as a tenfold increase in our traffic, peaking out at about 500,000 hits in a single day. So I'm very proud of the web team keeping all that, the wheels on through all that. The performance has been quite good, and we've haven't had any significant downtime. So I'm quite happy with all the eyeballs on our website. Just talking a little bit, I'm backing up a little bit here to talk about how we got to where we are. So last December, you might remember, we did a request for qualifications, and I brought that information to you. We were proposing to introduce a parallel track in order to jumpstart our efforts on the major facilities. This request for qualifications provided an opportunity for us to requalify our existing portfolio of professional service providers. And it also allowed us to introduce a few more candidates into the fold. So overall, we received 14 submittals. We got 5 bids. And for this initial scope of work, we chose IdeaBlade. As you can see from Ariana's demo, the scale approach seems to be effective for us. We were able to get a couple of tracks going at the same time in parallel, which is great. Here is the current team composition. So this table shows CNG and IT Depends are handling our design and quality assurance work. ClearSpark and IdeaBlade are handling our software development. Trinity is handling business analysis and data management for our legacy systems, while software development and website support are handled by Syllogy and Melinda Lai. So here it is. In conclusion, staff recommends the Board of Directors approve contract amendments in the amount of $1.9 million as detailed in Table 1 of the staff report and authorize the Air Pollution Control Officer to execute our contract amendments. And I'd like to open it up for questions at this point.
Mr. Sparing?
Can you talk a little bit about the security and who has access to all of this, you know, like on the permitting?
Sure.
Just expand on that a little bit.
The permitting, are you talking about the major facilities portal? Yeah, that work is, I described it as a sneak preview because it's currently not in production. And the way that component is going to work is as an internal administrative interface. So it's for our staff. The way the security works on it is using our Active Directory, so our internal domain services. Anybody who's validated on this domain can go and log into that system. And then it's all walled off behind its own VLAN or secure sub-network.
Okay. Director Chavez, then Sinks.
Thank you. I just wanted to make a couple of broad comments. One is I really appreciated the process that you went through. I appreciated that the information in our packets was connected to the contracts. You just did a really good job of being transparent. And when we're doing things that are this long, this complicated, and this expensive, that kind of transparency I think is really important. So I just wanted to say
thank you
and how much I appreciated it.
Thanks, Cindy. Director Sinks, then Joya.
Thank you. Well, it's quite a deal to manage 6 different consultants. Is there any lead, or are you serving as the lead trying to manage all of these folks?
I've been serving as the lead. Of course, I have the support of our executive team. And then I have 2 assistant managers. So I have an assistant manager looking after all the web activities. I've got one looking after all the data management. And then I'm in recruitment for a third. So
got
I'll
it.
Have kind of the 3 tracks with an assistant manager on each.
Well, you have my compliments as someone who's managed a lot of software before development, and it's no small feat. So those activities you listed, those activities you listed for 2019,
yep.
That's those are the services that are covered under the 1.9. that you're asking us to approve today.
Yeah, the 1.9 should cover us for roughly 6 months worth of development. It should take us up to near the end of the fiscal year. I imagine the way my budget's going to play out is there'll be some residual funds, so you'll probably see me here again April time frame.
So if we're looking at the lifespan of doing this monumental thing of getting us online, mm-hmm. What do you see as the ongoing rate of expenditure over the next year or so, year or 2, until you really think that, you know, you're in a steady state?
Yeah, it's on average, it's cost us somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 million a year.
Yeah.
And the point that we're at now, I'd like to begin to ramp down those costs on the external side, and I'd like to start bringing in more of our own staff to start ramping into the system. Ultimately, we need this managed by our own team.
Mm-hmm.
This is the point of bringing in some of the staff here. So through attrition, we're going to probably end up starting picking up new positions and filling those with folks that have the kind of technical skills that will allow us to support this thing. So I'm hoping for a taper off over the next 3 years.
We've had over time a number of members of the public that have expressed interest in more online information about major sources, among other things. Is any of the data we saw today, would that be available to the public?
Not at the moment. That particular module hasn't been put into production. It's, you can see it's a piece of software that's built and it's currently undergoing user acceptance testing internally.
Yeah.
So future plans are certainly a possibility.
Well,
you could extract certain information and make it available to the public.
Blair mentioned as part of the work that we're doing, there are enhancements that happen to the website and to the mapping. So currently online, you can go into any of our maps, see the facilities that are in your neighborhood, get the emissions from those facilities in broad brush strokes, and then if it is a Title V facility, you will have access to their permit, which is also online. So we've done that for the major facilities, and then we are, as we move out into the future, hopefully going to enhance those services. Mm-hmm. The critical pathway right now is just to get everything else online, and then we'll start to filter that information through better communication through our website to the public.
Okay, so getting this done for our internal use ought to eventually facilitate us making sure that we have good information for the public to the extent that we can do so.
Correct.
Thank you.
I think it lays that foundation, and then I think what you're referring to is the integration.
Yeah.
Yep.
Thanks, Rod.
Thank you.
Director Joya?
Thank you.
My question more has to do with sort of access. So maybe this is a question for Brian. So our permitting system is subject to the Public Records Act. So just to be clear, when things are transferred over to this system, a Public Records Act request for history of permitting and approvals would be then, the response would be the electronic materials on this. I just wanted to understand that.
Not necessarily. So all of our permits exist sort of in a digital frame,
right,
at some point. Historical information is imaged usually, so it's not in the active database. The stuff that you were looking at today is largely internal processing.
Mm-hmm.
Once the permit is issued, it has, we have a PDF version of it, and we also have a paper version of it. And that, of course, is a public record. But that internal processing is not a matter of public record. That's a deliberative process issue. So we get applications. Somebody sends in a request. And to the extent that's not a trade secret, there's pieces of it that are frequently, but, mm-hmm, but the public information in it is releasable. But some of the processing you saw today probably never would be. But the final result would be, and of course the proposal would be if it goes through that process.
Basically,
so there's elements of
it.
Right,
so the same things that were considered a public record under a previous system will be considered a public record here, even with the change of the format.
Of course.
Okay.
Yeah,
thanks.
That's consistent, and there are pieces that will be easier to provide when that integration happens, which right now it's a little bit cumbersome, but generally speaking, the same principles apply.
Cool. Director Rice.
Yeah, thank you. It was a great presentation. I had two questions. You talked about in the coming years bringing our own staff on board to, support the systems that we put in place. And so I'm assuming that when you're giving your projections around future costs, that includes a training element, because there is going to be some time and resources need towards training and supporting staffs going up the learning curve, yes?
That's a very good point. What we like to do, when possible, is the contractors that we have working on these projects, we like to encourage them to join us if they've been effective. So a number of us have come along through this process where we've worked as contractors and then ended up as employees. And so that typically reduces our learning curve quite a bit, as well as having the folks team directly.
Yeah, well, and to the degree that you can, I don't know if that's called poaching, yes or not, but that's
the
but I do think that just do
I would say on the, to err on the side of caution and conservative to have some resources set aside for training because.
And the other thing, so let me explain that other comment a little bit. Some of the contractors that we have are independent consultants, and so they work under an agency, and those folks typically like to look for full-time engagement.
So poaching wouldn't apply.
I don't believe we're necessarily poaching.
All right, second question.
But just to conclude, these folks that we bring in on the project, so Kevin, for example, is working in air quality. He's taken a role of a product designer, and so that teaches him a whole lot about the system and the product and our process. So I think we can not only just incorporate existing staff members into the team as well as the external folks. Together, that does reduce the training burden. I don't want to dismiss that comment, though, because this is a very complicated system, and the learning curve is at least 6 months to get people up to speed. So I think it's a valid point, and I just want you to know that we're thinking about it.
Good, good. And so second question, assuming that this system or this product, I'm thinking mostly around what you were showing us around the online permitting and compliance, it's not, we don't have a unique need here at in the Bay Area. The other air districts provide perform similar functions, and so they, I assume, have systems like this, and or where are we compared to the other air districts? And then if they are behind us, is there replicability towards, you know, looking towards being a good industry partner, sharing this kind of product?
Probably the most biased person to ask, but I'll say that we're well ahead of everyone in this front. and we're members of the CAPCOA IT group, so we share the information, particularly around the vendors that we're using and the approaches that we're taking. I did a similar product demo to that team a few months ago, let them know where we're at. But yeah, I would imagine there's a potential to share the technology.
Or sell it.
Okay. Wouldn't bother me.
Probably more share. We've seen elements of this technology from our vendor show up at other air districts, and we as good partners make sure that they have the benefit of our technical knowledge on those particular items.
Really,
so.
Really impressive, and you've come a long way. Really,
thank you very much.
We do have a public comment card on that, so we'll open up the public portion. Who's the first card?
I have Janet Stromberg.
Thank you. She's going to move you out, Blair.
Good morning. Janet Stromberg, 350 Bay Area. I just want to say I'm really impressed with how this whole project is going along. And a question I have is there a plan in place to provide a portal for once final decisions are made on permits and on emission inventories to have a good public interface for this so that perhaps we wouldn't have to file a Public Records Act request and so that the public could also sort through the data and access it easily by category, by source, and whatnot. Thank you.
Thank you. Okay, anyone else on public comment? Seeing none, we'll close it. Did you have a quick answer for this, or do we move on to a motion? Go
ahead. I'll move the item.
Well, relative to Ms. Stromberg's point, the question, the answer is yes, we're working on developing that interface. Okay. It's part of our overall plan.
Okay. We have a motion for the staff's recommendation from Joya, second from Rice. All those in favor say aye. Opposed, seeing none. AB 617, moving right along.
Mr. Chairman, members of the Executive Committee, Liz Ura is going to give you a presentation, an update on our efforts on 617. And I fully expect us probably to be speaking and talking about this as part of the retreat of the board in January, Director Rice. So since this is such a big priority for the district.
All right, good morning. So I will launch right in here. So just as a reminder for 617, we've done a lot this past year through this process. We identified and prioritized communities for action. The CARB board approved our recommendation for Richmond as a monitoring plan and West Oakland as an emissions reduction plan. We're currently working on new ways to build capacity within communities. deliver incentives to these communities. There's also requirements for statewide inventory and for different control technologies. So I'll go in quickly on where we are on each of those processes. So again, we had recommendations for West Oakland and Richmond as our year one communities. Those were approved by the CAR board in September, and we've been moving forward steadily with both of those communities in their two processes. So for the Richmond Monitoring Plan, where we're at is this past summer, we selected a consultant to help us with some facilitated discussions with the communities that we'll be having throughout the fall, leading up to what we are looking to call a community summit at some point in this winter. We really want to focus on continuing the 617 process to be community driven. And Richmond is a little bit different than West Oakland in that West Oakland, we had a strong community partner to help us move along the planning process. In Richmond, it's just a very different community there and much larger than West Oakland. So what we envisioned was some sort of community summit where we bring a lot of these community leaders together to discuss what would a steering committee look like, how does the selection process work, and how do we move forward knowing that we need to have a plan in place and monitoring on the ground by June of next year. And so we had recently our first kickoff meeting in Richmond. We had pretty rave reviews. Some people even said they had a really good time and they had fun there. So yay! I know, it was great. So it seems like we have a lot of interest in Richmond and are very hopeful moving forward that this will be a very strong community-driven process. Again, next steps after we have the structure of the steering committee is to get the monitors on the ground, collect the data, interpret results, and communicate the data all leading up to a final report. So this will all happen over the next year or two. For the West Oakland Action Plan, we've had about four or five steering committee meetings now with the group in West Oakland. Right now, we're going through the process of identifying sources, talking about emissions and the impact of those sources, and going through with the steering committee on the different strategies that could be used to control those sources, and also a key component, which is understanding the authority, who can actually enact regulations or ordinances in order to make sure those strategies get implemented. And then again, with the planning process, we'll be looking at various ways to evaluate the outcomes, such as looking at metrics and enforcement plans to be able to track progress of the plan. And so just a quick outline of what we did this past year. In July, we put together the steering committee and had our kickoff meeting there. Throughout September and October, we've been looking at and talking with the steering committee about what are the different planning elements that need to go in an emission reduction plan, looking at all the different sources in West Oakland and talking about the great deal of citizen science that's already gone on in the West Oakland community over the past few decades. We've been more recently talking about the technical assessment, all the technical work, including the neighborhood scale inventory that needs to be put together for West Oakland, and also talking about the enforcement authorities that the various agencies have in West Oakland. This past steering committee, we just talked about the health impacts of the different sources that are in West Oakland and talked with the steering committee about prioritizing sources and what that looks like and what are the different things as a community member you need to consider when talking about prioritizing sources. And then over the next few months, I think we'll really be, even though these have been very meaty discussions already, I think we're really, really going to have to start digging in with the steering committee on what are the different metrics that will be used to define success for this emission reductions plan. We'll be finishing up our technical analysis on the air district side on the source attribution, and then we'll be looking at actually defining out all the different strategies that the community wants to see in the plan. And so the goal is to have the plan in a draft form by March so that we can go through the CEQA process.
That's quick.
Yes. So aside from the monitoring plan and the emissions reduction plan, there's a whole other set of communities that we'll be looking at to identify over the next few years. And I know we've talked a lot about the need for capacity because not everyone is going to have a group like the West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project, where they have decades of experience in doing citizen science and really understand the air quality challenges in their community. So the question is, for these other communities that we've talked about that are going to be in the queue for the next few years, what do we need to do in those communities in order to build them up to the level where they can partner with us and really lead a planning effort moving forward? And so we're looking at developing a building capacity plan for these communities, which would start out with building relationships, learning about the different community members and organizations, talking with the local governments and the regional agencies. Because the next thing we need to do is really move into the needs assessment and figure out, not only with the community members, but with the local governments, what are the gaps that we need to help fill? I think one lesson learned in West Oakland is that, there will be some actions we will ask of the local city government in this process. And if we're hearing from them, they don't have the resources to participate or to enact some of these strategies, what can we do to get those local governments there as well so that they can be there to answer the requests of the community members when it comes to local jurisdictional issues. And then after the needs assessment, what we want to do is work with local community members on implementing strategies in their various communities, whether it be technical assistance, training and technology transfer, more participatory research, or other processes that we can do to really build relationships and start building the knowledge base in these communities moving forward. So this is a plan we'll be working on implementing over the next few months into the next few years as we move along with the 617 process. For incentives, for the past fiscal year, we had received about $50 million to fund various different mobile sources, and we're still looking forward to receiving this current fiscal year money, which an exciting new component is really being able to look at stationary sources and other types of exposure reduction measures that are going to come out of these emission reductions planned. So we're still in the process of talking with communities about what types of things they would like to see funded as far as stationary sources and emission reduction programs moving forward. And as far as the money that we have now, there is about a little less than half of it already allocated to date. As you can see, a good number of school buses, off-road, on-road, marine locomotive equipment is already allocated with this past funding round. So still a lot of money left to go, and we're really looking forward to seeing what comes out of these emission reductions plans and how we can use funding to really fill in some of those gaps. So under AB 617, the California Air Resources Board is required to come up with a uniform statewide reporting system for toxics and criteria pollutants. These are four affected facilities that emit over 250 tons per year that are already subject to GHG reporting and also have an elevated prioritization score. They already released a draft this past summer, and the Air District did submit comments on that reporting system, and we will continue to work with industry, the Air Board, and also through CAPCOA to make sure that a system is designed that works for everybody and that continues to incorporate all the reporting that we already have going on. And then the BARC schedule. Under 617, the district was required to come up with an accelerated best available retrofit control technology schedule to look at some of the larger sources, industrial sources under cap and trade that met various criteria, like they have not had BARC'd revised recently and are in affected communities. And so we've talked about BARC'd in front of the members of the board quite a bit this past year. And in December, you will be seeing a proposed BARC'd schedule from staff to act on at that point. We do have six items that we have in our BARC'd schedule currently. Several involve refineries, and then there are some additional ones in there for Portland Cement and like industries as well. So you'll be seeing a more in-depth report on that at the December board meeting. And what's next? A lot of things still. We'll be looking forward again, as I mentioned, to the Community Summit in Richmond. We'll be selecting strategies over the next couple months to include in the emission reduction plan there. And again, once we have the BARC schedule finalized and submitted to the California Air Resources Board at the end of the year, we have a couple years ahead of us of actually going through the rulemaking schedule for all those activities outlined in the schedule there, along with capacity building, more incentives, et cetera, et cetera. So a lot going on 617, and I'm sure I'll be back up here in front of you frequently with updates as things progress.
Liz drew the short straw, so she's going to be up in front of you quite a bit. Now, she's doing a great job as our Director of Community Protections.
Okay. And there is a lot. We do have a speaker card. You want them first? Okay. Who's public comment is open? Who is it?
Janet Skull Johnson.
Okay. Janet, please come up. While she's up, please note this is an executive board meeting. The regular or special meeting will follow directly afterwards. Go ahead, Janet.
The one that says push, right? Okay, thanks. Good morning. I'm Janet Skull Johnson. I have lived in Richmond for 37 years. And I owned a business for 17 of those years. I owned and operated an electrical contracting company, and I've also taught in the Richmond Public Schools. And I have also been a community organizer for all those years plus. And I serve on the coordinating committee of Sunflower Alliance, which is the fossil fuel campaign of 350 Bay Area. And I'm on the core committee of No Coal in Richmond. So I have questions, particularly as speaking to the relationship building and authentic participation aspect of the AB 617 process. First, I will have a couple of comments regarding the November 7th meeting, and then I have some questions and recommendations. So those that I have spoken to feel that our values are being bypassed, that we're being rushed into a process that we've had no say in creating. We're not interested in providing input and feedback. We need to have a real community-based process that reflects the values and is defined by the members of the community. Okay, according to the CARB blueprint, this process is designed to have co-leaders, the Air District, and a community-based organization. To the best of my knowledge, that organization has not yet been identified. How can you proceed without the community-based organization? At the meeting on November 7th, only 46% of those were Richmond residents, 46 of those present. 50% by your own count, 50% of the attendees were either from business and industry or from government agencies. The word community was bandied around over and over and over again. But Richmond's environmental justice community was barely represented. Those community members in attendance were not adequately prepared on what they were expected to do at this meeting. The PowerPoint presentation was rushed through. There were no hard copies of the PowerPoint presentation. The meeting began at 5:30, making it difficult for working people who commute to Oakland or San Francisco to get there. My questions and recommendations. We do not want polluters on the Community Steering Committee. I will repeat, we do not want polluters on the Community Steering Committee. There were people paid by Chevron at this meeting. I will continue at the next portion of your meeting. Thank you.
Thank you, Janet. Okay, any other public comments?
Can I ask Elizabeth just to respond? Because there is going to be a process. There is going to be a process for co-leads. In fact, my understanding at that meeting is that community-based organizations were asked, folks were asked if they were willing to play a role on co-lead. So can you talk about, because that is an important element, is the co-leads would be community-based organizations helping lead this process. Can you talk about that?
And I think, in West Oakland, we had a pretty clear co-lead defined, again, with the West Oakland Environmental Indicators Project already have been so active. This past spring, we actually had put out a request for entities that may want to act as a co-lead, so community organizations. And unfortunately, at that point, we didn't have anyone respond. When we talked with a lot of the different community groups in Richmond, it was an issue of capacity. It was, well, air quality is important, but you know, crime prevention is also important. Access to food is also important. We are very oversubscribed right now. And so when we heard that feedback, we took a step back and said, okay, what we're going to try and do is bring on a facilitator to help out. A facilitator that was selected was MIG to be able to help support any of the community groups that wanted to be involved and to be able to give them some of the resources that they may need. And with talking with MIG, what we moved forward with doing was having this just introductory Richmond meeting that wasn't supposed to be a steering committee meeting. It was really just a informational meeting on what we think we could have a process, you know, what was our idea for a process moving forward. And at that meeting, what we asked was, are there any groups that want to partner with us to be able to be the co-leads for the community? So we did ask at that meeting if there were any groups that were interested in co-leads with us. And then the idea moving forward was that the co-leads would work with MIG, the facilitator, to design themselves what would a community summit look like. How would what time of day would it be? What would the structure be to be most amenable to have community representatives move forward? And at that community-led meeting, decide what the steering committee structure would look like and what the process would be moving forward.
And if I can add a comment, I think that's an important point. There are going to be community organizations that are going to co-lead this process. And I want to make a distinction because I was at the meeting. I think the meeting was a public meeting. So you can't discourage anybody from it. You can't tell people not to come. So, and it was a good turnout, and there were a lot of community folks there. And yes, the folks from government were probably the City of Richmond, the Air District, the State Air Board, all really important folks to have at this meeting. Yes, there were business folks there. But remember, this was not the Community Steering Committee. The community steering committee that will come out of a community process is going to be overwhelmingly, under the guidelines issued by the State Air Resources Board, community folks, community residents. So just like anything, when you hold a meeting anywhere, you can't stop people at the door. So if a business shows up, you can't tell them not to come. Now, you can select who's going to be on the community steering committee, which will be hopefully this community-led process by these co-leads, community-based organizations based in Richmond, that will then select. Let me just say something really clear. Unlike the South Coast Air District, unlike the Central Valley Air District, this air district is not picking who's going to be on the community steering committee. It is developing this community process, this summit, that will help decide who gets picked. I talked to folks at the South Coast Air District and the Central Valley Air District, and Jack knows this. They're taking an application process where I think their board, their district is picking. We don't want to do that here. We want the community, the process actually issued by the Air Resources Board, which is a community-led process. It did, the community, the guidelines issued by CARB did say it should predominantly be people who live or work in Richmond. Does that mean there be maybe one or two folks from industry on there? Probably. Does it mean overwhelmingly most of them are community folks who aren't industry? Yes. So I think that's what this community process is going to lead to. But then even the community steering committee will have public meetings of which anybody can show up, and that's what will happen. So I thought there was a pretty good cross-section of people. Could there be more? Yes, because people are busy. And the future time and date of these future meetings will be determined by ultimately the co-leads, right? These community co-leads. This was just the first KIPP meeting, and it was meant to be just an introduction and a discussion of how do we go forward. And so once you identify the co-leads, they're going to run the show with MIG being their support facilitator, is my understanding, right?
Right.
Yeah.
Director Chavez.
So thank you. And I'm going to be a little more mundane with my comments. One is that this is such an incredible process that one of the opportunities, I think, is to take a look at plans that the Air District already has and be able to highlight where there's alignment with those plans, even as you make presentations to the board. Because I think part of what I want to be able to better understand is how we're integrating external activities to the activities of the Air Resources Board in a really broad sense. And to that end, I want to make sure that, you know, even though I find some of, I know a lot of the stuff that we produce isn't really like exciting reading for folks, that making sure we have executive summaries for people who come to our, to meetings, especially around like our big air, clean air plan and how our local plan is already aligned with what 617 is doing. And the second thing that I was thinking about was even the diesel free by 33, like how do those activities that we're already going to be engaged in really knit into the community? And they may not, and that's an okay thing to say that in these instances this wasn't something that was adopted. I think that's actually very important for the board to understand. And then the last thing I'll say is I think it's really wise of bringing MIG in. I haven't worked with them in a while, but I did work with them a while back, and I think they're very skilled facilitators. Mm-hmm. And one thing that I would recommend is at the beginning of processes, as you know, they're iterative and they're painful, and people are always nervous that they're going to be left out and that there will be one thumb or another on the scale weighing their interests out or someone else's in. And I think whenever you're ready for this and the community's really engaged, printing a process map so that people know where we are in the process and really can check the box. The graphics you did for us are really great, but using something like this that says here's where we actually are in the process, I think will help people both as they come to meetings, but also in terms of people understanding when what kind of input needs to be engaged in really bright like this, characters might be really helpful.
Thank you.
Okay, Director Joy, you had one other.
I wanted to add one other. I wanted to first thank Janet for being a voice there, and I think, and your comments, I think those are important because we need that voice to continue moving this process. And I'm optimistic, Janet, how it will turn out. But I think we're going to continue to have strong community voices like yours. And so I encourage you. Obviously, you're going to be staying involved to continue that voice, continue keeping this going in that direction. And I'm optimistic about how the process going forward. So thanks.
Okay, thank you. Anything more, Elizabeth? No? Okay, then we will accept the report. Thank you very much for the update. Next and last item is?
Marcy?
No, we're good. Okay. I asked this to be put on committee chair reports on board of director meeting agendas, basically for the benefit of staff and the three upcoming officers. Repeatedly over the last 10 years, I've had discussions where why do we do these reports, stationary, mobile, et cetera, and can we put it on the consent calendar? If somebody wishes to pull it, you decide between the next chair where you would put it if somebody pulls it. So I would like to get some feedback. Is this something the next three chairs or the next chair in particular could do? Cindy, you pointed at me. Go ahead.
Yeah, as the incoming chair, I would. I think it's a good recommendation. I think we can easily, as you said, if someone has an interest in discussing something that was coming out of that committee report, or if we're acting on as part of the consent item, they can pull it and we can take it, discuss it separately. So I think it makes sense for efficiency, mm-hmm. and I'm not sure that us reading aloud the summarized report really adds anything.
Okay, Mark, Brad, Carol, I heard agree. Agreed, right?
My only comment is sometimes as we're reading these long statements, there are things that are really significant.
Yeah.
The Mobile Source Committee has done. Maybe those highlights could be brought forward in the CEO report, okay. The XO report.
Okay. Sounds good. Very good comment. Now with Jim.
I think it's a good suggestion, but we should leave it up to the chair of that committee whether they feel that they should expand on the report itself.
Sounds very good. Okay, you've got direction, Mark?
I think overall it's a good idea. I think the ones where you have significant expenditures
yeah.
Being
voted on that it should get more of a at least a brief synopsis. It doesn't have to be a one-page readout, but what the actual expenditure is, and maybe set a threshold of if it's over 50,000 or some pertinent threshold, I think might be smart.
I think that's good feedback for the next three chairs. And I mean, this is along the lines of review and discuss it rather than just wonder. So if that's okay, you've received the comments. We'll move on to public comment. Do we have any cards? Public comment is open. Seeing nobody rush forward, they want to do it at the next one. Committee members, remarks. Seeing none, time and place of the next meeting will be at the call of Chair Rice, more than likely. Okay, we are adjourned. It will take about 5 minutes to get set up for the special meeting, and thank you all for coming early. I know this all excited you very much. Gee, Merry Christmas. This is a rough house tonight.